not have succeeded, he would have been unhappy. Joey, he thought. And he put the thoughts into words. Joey was too much like me. I always struggle. I can never merely be happy. He concentrated on a small chip of granite and vindictively pounded it into bits. Relax, relax, he again thought in words. It's time to relax. Thoreau and Gauguin, we remember them. But should we forget the tens of thousands of others? They neither wrote books nor painted pictures, but equally they renounced. And what are those others, the millions who turned their backs on imagination? You have heard them speak and seen their eyes. It was fine there, where we camped on our fishing trip. Sometimes I wished, of course, I had to get back for the sales conference. Do you ever think George of a desert island? Just a cabin in the woods, no telephone? The sand spit by the lagoon? I like to fancy, but, you know, there's Maud and the children. What a strange thing, then, is this great civilization that no sooner have men attained it than they seek to flee from it. The Chaldeans told that Oannes, the fish god, came up from the sea and taught men these new ways. But was he god or demon? Why do the legends look back towards some golden day of simplicity? Must we not think, then, that this great civilization grew up not by men's desires, but rather by forces and pressures? Step by step, as villages grew larger, men must give up the free wandering life of berry picking and seed gathering and tie themselves to the security and drudgery of agriculture. Step by step, as villages grew more numerous, men must renounce the excitement of the hunt for the security and drudgery of cattle keeping. Then, at last, it was like Frankenstein's vast monster. They had not willed it, but it ruled them all. And so by a thousand little surreptitious paths, they tried to escape. How then, once overthrown, shall this great civilization, except by renewed forces and pressures, ever come again? And then suddenly he knew that he was old. In years, he was only in his 40s. But he was the youngest of the older group. And beneath him, a long gap opened before you came to the oldest of the younger ones. It was a long gap in years, and an immensely longer gap in culture and tradition. Never had there been, never could there possibly have been, such another gap between the older and the younger generations. Sitting there on the library steps, pounding the chip of granite into smaller and smaller grains, he began now to have what seemed a little clearer vision of the future. It was all tied up in that same old question: how much did man strike outward to affect all his surroundings? And how much did the surroundings press in upon him? Did the Napoleonic Age produce Napoleon, or did he produce it? So even if Joey had lived, the welter of circumstances, the circumstances that made Jack and Roger and Ralph, would probably have affected Joey too, and one small boy was not much to set up against all of that. Yes, even if Joey had lived, things would probably have continued to move in the way they already seemed to be moving. Now that Joey was dead, it was certain. Certain, that is, as far as anyone could reasonably expect, granting always some unforeseeable accident. The stars and their courses. The chip of granite was nothing but powder under the blows of the hammer. The stars in their courses. No, he did not believe in astrology, and yet the shifting of the stars showed that the solar system, too, was changing, and that the Earth itself was becoming a more or less habitable place for man. Thus, at some profounder depth of reality, astrology might be right. And the changes in the sky could be taken as symbol of all the grinding wheels of circumstance. the stars and their courses? What was man, little man, to withstand them? Yes, the future was certain. The tribe was not going to restore civilization. It did not want civilization. For a while, the scavenging would go on. This opening of cans, this expending of cartridges and matches stored up from the past, all this uncreative but happy manner of life. Then at last, sooner or later, there would be more and more people, and the supplies would fail. There would perhaps be no quick catastrophe because many cattle could be had for the taking, and life would go on. So, he thought. And then a new idea came to him with a sudden impact. Even though cattle were left, though there was much food, what would happen when the ammunition for the rifles was exhausted, when the matches were gone? In fact, one might not even have to wait until the ammunition was exhausted. Powder deteriorated with time. 3 or 4 generations and all who were left might be merely some groveling primitives who had lost civilization and yet, on the other hand, had not learned all those 1,000 basic skills which enabled savages to live with some degree of stability and comfort. Possibly indeed, and perhaps this would be best, in 3 or 4 generations, the race would not be able to survive at all, would not be able to make the transition between the scavenging, uncreative life and some new level of life at which they could remain permanently or from which they could once more begin a slow advance. Again, he pounded heavily on the edge of the step. Another chunk of the granite fell off. He looked at it gloomily. He had just decided not to worry, and here he was, hard at it again. What could he know about what would be happening 3 or 4 generations from now? He got up and started to walk home. He was quieter now. Yes, he thought, again shaping words, a leopard can't change its spots, and I'll always be a worrier, even though I've lived with M for 22 years. I look before and after. I'll relax. Yes, I should relax a little. What I have been trying to do, that has failed. I'll admit it. Just the same, I'm certain I'll never stop trying a little. Now, perhaps, if I try for something less, I may in the end attain something more. Chapter 10. By the time he had finished the long walk up the hill to the houses, his vague plans had shaped themselves, but he would have to wait until morning to begin. That night, however, an autumn storm began, and he awoke in the morning to a world of low-lying cloud and steady dripping. He felt surprise, for with all the recent troubles, he had failed to realize that time was slipping away. Now, however, when he thought of the matter, he remembered that the sun had been setting well toward the south and that the month, if one could still think in such terms, would be November. The rain interfered with the immediate fulfillment of his plans, but there was plenty of time, and he could mature his ideas with thought. So completely had his attitudes changed within the last day that the sounds of the assembling children, that morning, came to him as a shock. Of course, he thought. They are expecting to have school again. He went downstairs to meet with them. They were all there, all except Joey and 2 younger ones. He looked into their faces as they sat on chairs wriggling or squatted more comfortably on the floor. They were looking back at him, he imagined, with more alertness than usual. Joey was gone, and they must be wondering how this would affect school. Yet the change, he knew, must be only temporary, and behind this alertness must lurk still that basic lack of interest against which he had already struggled. He let his glance run over the little group, pausing individually upon each face. They were fine children, not really stupid, but they lacked the flair. No, there was not one. He made his decision, and he felt no pain in it. School is dismissed, he said. There was a momentary look, almost as of consternation on all the faces, and then he saw that they were suddenly pleased, although they were making some effort not to show their pleasure. School is dismissed, he repeated, feeling that he was being dramatic about it in spite of himself. There will be no more school, ever. Again, he saw a look of consternation come into the faces, and this time, no pleasure showed afterward. They stirred uneasily in their seats. Some of them got up to go. But they knew that something had happened, something deeper than their minds could grasp. They went out slowly and quietly. During as much as a minute after they had gone out into the dripping of the rain, there was silence. Then he heard them suddenly shout, and they were children again. School had been a passing incident. Probably they would never think of it again. Certainly they would never regret it. For a moment, Ish felt a heaviness within him. Joey, Joey, he thought. But he had no regret for what he had just done, and he knew that he had made the right decision. School is dismissed, he thought. School dismissed. And he remembered suddenly that he had sat in the same room many years before and watched the electric lights fade out. 3 days of rain gave him plenty of time to think things over and mature all his plans. At last, a morning dawned with blue sky and a chilly wind from the north. The sun came out, the vegetation dried. Now was the time. He hunted through the deserted and overgrown gardens. This had never been an area where citrus fruits were grown commercially, but lemons had produced well enough, and here and there, someone had nursed a lemon tree in his garden. That wood, he remembered, was suitable. Of course, he could have read any number of books, but his approach had changed. He would read no books on this matter. He could do well enough by himself. 2 blocks up the street, there had once been a large and showy garden. There he found a lemon tree. It was still living, although nearly crowded out by the growth of 2 pines. Moreover, it had suffered badly in a frost of some years previous. Never having been pruned after the frost, the tree was only a wreck of itself. Long suckers had shot up from its base after the frost, and some of these again had died. Avoiding the long thorns, Ish pressed his way into the tangle, found a suitable shoot, and took out his pocket knife. The shoot at its base was nearly as big as his thumb. The dead lemon wood was almost as hard as bone. But after a while, he whittled it through with his knife and pulled it out from the tangle. The shoot was 7 feet long, straight for 4 feet before other branches had begun to interfere, and it had grown crooked. At his shaking, it was stiff. But when he leaned against it, it bent and straightened sharply as he released the pressure. It would suffice. Yes, he thought a little bitterly. It will be good enough for all my needs. He carried the lemon shoot back to the house and sat on the porch in the sun, whittling. First, he cut off the crooked end of the shoot so that he had 4 feet of straight wood remaining. Then he stripped off the dead bark and began to taper the shoot at both ends. The work was very slow, and he paused frequently to sharpen the knife on a whetstone. The white, tough-grained wood seemed to turn the edge after only a few strokes. Walt and Josie had been off playing with the other children, but at lunchtime they came back. "What are you doing?" Josie asked him. "I'm getting ready to play a game," Ish answered her. He would not make the mistake, he had decided, of trying to tie this up with anything practical, as he had with the school. Here he would try to harness that love of play, which seemed so deep-seated in the human race. After lunch, the children must have carried the word around. In the afternoon, George came over.
"Why don't you come to my place," George said, "and use a vise and my spokeshave? You could work a lot faster."
Ish thanked him, but continued to work with the knife, even though his hand was getting sore. Nevertheless, He thought that he would do all this work with the simplest implements. By the end of the afternoon, his hand was beginning to blister where he held the knife. But he judged that the work was done. A 4-foot length of the lemon shoot was now symmetrically tapered toward both ends. He set one end of it against the ground, pressed it to a half circle, and felt it spring back sharply into straightness. Satisfied, he cut notches close to each end and gladly put the knife away. The next morning, he continued the work. There was plenty of stout string available, and he considered taking some nylon fish line and braiding it into the proper size. No, he thought, I'll work from things they can always get for themselves. He found the skin of a recently killed calf. From it, he cut a long thong of rawhide. The work went slowly, but he had plenty of time. He shaved the hair from the strip and shaved the strip itself until it was no larger than a small cord. Then he braided 3 strips together to make a heavy cord, and, estimating the proper length, he tied each end into a little loop. He held the lemon shoot in one hand and the braided thong in the other and looked at them. Either by itself amounted to little. Then, bending the shoot, he hooked the loops of the thong into the notches at the ends of the shoot, and the two became one. Since the thong was shorter, the tapered shoot now bent in a clean symmetrical arc. The thong itself cut straight across between the points of the arc. Stick and cord joined had suddenly become something new. He looked at the bow and knew that creative force had again returned to the world. He could have gone to any sporting goods store and picked out a much better bow, a 6-foot toy for archery. But he had not done so. He had made himself a bow from the wood itself, carved with the simplest of implements, and a string from the hide of a new killed calf. He plucked at the thong. It scarcely twanged, but it gave forth a satisfactory dull throbbing vibration. He considered that his work for the day was finished. He unstrung the bow. The next day, for an arrow, he cut himself a straight branch of a pine tree. The soft green wood cut easily, and he had shaped the arrow and notched it in half an hour. When he had finished it, he called for the children. Walt and Josie came and Weston with them. Let's see how she works, Ish said. He drew the arrow back and loosed it. Unfeathered, it flew with a wobbly flight. But he had pointed it at a high angle, and it covered 50 feet before it struck, by chance, pointing upward from the ground. Instantly, he knew that he had won success. The 3 children had never seen anything like this before, and they stood wide-eyed for a moment. Then, with shouts, they broke into a run and went to retrieve the arrow. Ish shot it for them, again and again. At last came the inevitable request for which Ish had been waiting. Let me try it, Daddy, said Walt. Walt's first shot wobbled a bare 20 feet, but he was pleased. Then Josie tried it, and then Weston. Before dinner time, every child in the tribe was busy at work whittling on a bow of his own. Everything worked even better than Ish had dared to hope. Within a week, the air around the houses seemed to be full of badly shot arrows. Mothers began to worry about lost eyesight, and 2 children came in crying after having received arrows in various parts of their anatomies. But since the arrows were headless and shot from weak bows, no real harm resulted. Rules had to be established. You mustn't shoot in the direction of anyone. You mustn't shoot close to the houses. Competition developed. Having learned the trick from the older boys who shot from rifles, children began to hold contests against a mark. They experimented with different lengths and types of bows. When Josie complained that Walt always beat her at shooting, Ish suddenly made the suggestion that she might try fixing some quail pinions to the butt end of her arrow. She did so and beat Walt, and then suddenly all the arrows had quail pinions at one end, and they were flying farther and truer. Even the older boys became interested, and some of them made bows, although they were allowed to use rifles.
but archery still continued to flourish chiefly among the ones who were too young for rifles. Ish bided his time. The early rains had sprouted the grass seed, and now the land was green. At evening, the sun set behind the hills to the south of the Golden Gate. Walt and Weston, the 12-year-olds, were now deep in some kind of boyish plot. They worked hard with bows and arrows, shaping and perfecting them. They were gone long hours during the day. Then one day toward evening, Ish heard the sound of excited boys' feet running up the steps outside. Walt and Weston burst into the room. "Look, Daddy!" Walt cried, and he held up for Ish the pathetic-looking body of a big rabbit pierced through the side with a headless wooden arrow. "Look!" Walt cried again. "I hid behind a bush and waited till he hopped up close to me, and then I shot him right through." Ish, as he looked, felt a sympathy and pity for the poor dangling body, even though he knew that it was a symbol of his triumph. Too bad, he thought, that even creation must make use of death. "That's fine," he said. "That's fine, Walt. That was a good shot." Chapter 11. Day after day still, the sun set in the cloudless sky farther to the south. Now it was very close to its turning. The clear weather still held. One day, so suddenly that you might almost say, just at that particular moment it happened, the children became tired of playing with bows and arrows and went off on some new enthusiasm. Ish did not worry. He knew that after the ways of children, they would come back again, perhaps at the same time of year. The making of bows and the shooting of arrows would not be forgotten. During 20 years, during 100 years, if need were, the bow might remain a children's plaything. In the end, after the ammunition had failed, it would still be there. It was the greatest weapon that primitive man had ever known, and the most difficult to invent. If he had saved that for the future, he had saved much. After the rifles were useless, his great-grandchildren would not have to meet the bear's rush empty-handed or starve in the midst of the cattle herds. His great-grandchildren would never know civilization, but at least they would not be groveling half-apes, but would walk erect as free men, bow in hand. Even if they should no longer have metal knives, they could still scrape out bows with sharp stones. He planned one more experiment, but he was in no hurry. Now that they had bows, he could make a bow drill and teach the children its use. Then, after the matches were exhausted, the tribe would still know how to kindle fire. Yet, as with the children, his own enthusiasm too grew cool through the passing of the weeks. He thought less upon his own triumph in inventing the bow and tricking the children into enjoying it. He thought rather upon all the disasters of the year. Joey was gone, and that loss could never be redeemed. Also, a kind of fresh innocence had faded from the world when the four of them had written that word upon their ballots. And also, a great confidence and trust had gone from himself when he'd realized at last that he must give up his dream of reestablishing the ways of civilization. Now the sun was so near the limit of its southern course that a day or two would bring its turning. Everyone was making ready for the holiday, and the carving of the number in the rock and the naming of the year. This was their great holiday of all, combining as it did both Christmas and New Year's of the old times, and yet including along with those two something of their individual own. Like so much else, the holidays had suffered strange transitions in the passage of one world to the other. They still observed Thanksgiving Day with a big dinner, but the 4th of July and all the other patriotic holidays had lapsed. George, who was a traditionalist and had been a good Union man, always knocked off whatever he was doing and wore his best clothes when he judged it should be Labor Day. But no one else celebrated it with him. Curiously, or perhaps rather it was natural enough, the old folk holidays survived better than those established by law.
The children still celebrated April Fool's Day and Halloween with great enthusiasm, and with much of the traditional ceremony, although they had had to learn such things from their fathers and mothers. Also, 6 weeks after the winter solstice, they talked about Ground Squirrel Day and whether the squirrel could see his shadow, for there were no groundhogs in this area, and they had substituted the ground squirrel instead. Yet all these were nothing compared with their own great festival when they cut the number in the rock and named the year. Now Ish began to hear the children discussing the matter and speculating upon what the name would be. The younger ones were saying that it should be called the Year of the Bow and Arrow. But the slightly older ones, who could remember more vividly the whole year, said that rather it should be called the Year of the Journey. But those who were still older thought of other things also, and often they grew quiet and seemed embarrassed. And Ish knew that they were thinking of Charlie and of all the other deaths. Ish himself thought first of all about Joey, and then of all the changes of attitude which he himself had had to make during the year. Then finally, as they looked out one evening, they saw that the sun set in the same place, or perhaps a little to the north from where it had set the night before. And the older one said, to the great excitement of the children, that tomorrow would be the day. So again, at the end of the 22nd year, they gathered at the rock, and Ish, with his hammer and cold chisel, cut 22 into the surface of the rock, just below 21. They were all there at the rock, because the day was fair and warm for winter, and the mothers had brought even the youngest babies. Then, after the numeral had been cut, all those who were old enough to talk called out Happy New Year, as it had been in the old times, and as it was still at this time. But when Ish asked, following the ritual set in the last years, what should be the name of the year, there came only sudden silence. At last the one to speak was Ezra, the good helper, who knew the ways of men. Too much has happened this year, and whatever name we give the year will have a bad sound to us. People find comfort in numbers, and no bad thoughts. Let us give this year no name, but remember it only as the year 22. Here ends part two. The second interchapter, called Quick Years, follows, without time interval. Quick Years. Once again the years flowed quickly, and now no longer he struggled and thrashed, but instead floated easily with the current. In these years they grew a little corn, not much, but enough to harvest a small crop and to keep the seeds alive. Every autumn, as at the falling of the first rain gave a signal, the children played with bows and arrows for a while before they tired of the game. Now and then all the adults drew together to a conference, like a town meeting, and what was decided there, each one knew, was binding upon them all. These things, at least, Ish thought. These things, at least, I have assured for the future. Yet in the meetings, more and more with every year, those who spoke and took action were young men. Ish, to be sure, presided. He sat facing all the others, and those wishing to speak rose and addressed him respectfully. He sat there, holding his hammer, or balancing it beside him. When argument between two of the young men became too heated, Ish pounded with the hammer, and the young men were suddenly quiet and deferential. But if he himself spoke, though they listened intently, often they paid no attention to his ideas afterward. So the years flowed. The year 23 of the Mad Wolf. The year 24 of the Blackberries. The year 25 of the Long Rain. Then came the year 26, and old George was with them no more. He had been painting on a ladder. Whether his heart stopped and he fell, or whether he fell accidentally and killed himself by falling, no one ever knew. But he was gone, and after his death, the roofs were never in such good repair, and the trim was never painted. Maureen lived on for a while in the neat house where the pink-fringed bridge lamps would not light and the console radio would not play and the scarves were crumpled on the tables. but she too was old and she died before the year was out. So they called it the year when George and Maureen died. And still they ran on, 27, 28, 29, 30. It was hard to remember now the names and how they came. Was the good corn year before the red sunset year? And did that come after the year when Evie died? Poor Evie. They buried her next to the others, and in her grave at least, she was no different. All those years she had lived with them, and whether she had been happy, no one knew. And whether they had done well to keep her living. Only once in all those years had she mattered much, and yet for that little time, when Charlie had come, she had seemed very important. Now that she was gone, the young people scarcely missed her. Nevertheless, the older ones remembered that her going marked still another broken link with the old times. With Evie gone, only five of the original ones remained. Jean and Ish were the youngest of these five, and age showed least in them, although Ish limped more and more from his old wound. Molly complained of vague illnesses and wept often. Ezra coughed with his dry cough. Even Em walked with a less sure and regal grace. Yet actually, they all enjoyed amazingly good health for people of their years, and their various decrepitudes sprang chiefly from approaching old age. The year 34, that was an important one. They had known for some time that there was another but smaller group of people living across north of the bay. But in this year, the surprise was that the other people sent a messenger with the proposal of a union. Ish made the young man keep distance, for he wanted no repetition of that business of Charlie. Having got all the information he could from the messenger, he called a meeting. Ish sat with his hammer, for it was a time of great state. There was a hot argument. Reinforcing the fear of disease was a prejudice against strangers and all their strange ways. On the other hand, a kind of fascination in the very strangeness combated the prejudice. Besides, there was the strong desire to strengthen the numbers of the tribe, and particularly to obtain wives. For in late years, fewer girls than boys had been born, and some of the young men had nowhere to look. To Ish, also there was the argument that the inbreeding of the tribe might be dangerous. For now blood relationship was universal, and everyone had to marry his cousin. But Ish himself, along with Ezra, opposed the union. In overwhelming fear of disease, Jack and Ralph and Roger, the oldest of the younger men, remembered the year 22 and supported Ish and Ezra. But the still younger men, especially the unmarried ones, clamored for the union, and Ish could see that the thought of the girls of that other tribe excited them. Then Em spoke. Her hair was holy gray now, but her calm voice held them.
"I have said it before," she said. "Life is not lived by denying life. Our sons and grandsons will need wives. Perhaps death will come also, but that too we must face."
Not so much by what she said as by the spirit that flowed out from her, they all had courage. They voted without dissent to admit the others. This time luck was with them, for the only epidemic was that the others contracted measles and soon were well again. After that time, there was always a division within the tribe, as of two clans, the first ones and the others. When they intermarried, the children were of their father's clan, although Ish had wondered whether mother lineage might not prevail, as with many primitive people. But the old tradition of the Americans was too strong. Then, in the next year, Ish realized more than ever that Em walked no longer with that regal grace. Suddenly, when he looked at her, he saw strange lines in her face, not the lines of old age, but the lines of pain. Behind the darkness of the cheeks, there was not the glow of red, but an ashy gray. Deep within him, he felt chill and fear, and he knew that this also had come close to its end. Sometimes, In those grim months that followed, he thought to himself, this may be merely appendicitis. The pain is in that place. Why can I not operate? I can read the books. I could find out how it is done. One of the boys could manage the ether. At worst, I would only end the pain. But always he realized that it could not be, for his hands were no longer young and sure, and his courage, too, perhaps had grown weak, so that he dared not draw the knife edge across the side of her whom he loved. So he knew that M must face the future alone. Before long, too, he knew that this was not appendicitis. As the sun swung southward again, she weakened and walked no more. He hunted in the ruinous drugstores and found powders and syrups, so that at least she suffered little. After she had taken the medicine, she would sleep or lie quietly, smiling. Then after a while, when the pain again began to make her toss, he would think, perhaps I should make the dose larger still and bring a finish to all pain. But he did not. For she, he knew, had always reached out toward life, and her courage would not fail. So he sat long hours by the bed, holding her hand, and now and then they talked. As it always had been, she was the one who comforted him, although she was the one who lay in pain and was going. Yes, he realized, she had been mother as well as wife. Don't worry, she said once, about the children, I mean, and the grandchildren and all those that will come after. They will be happy, I think. At least, they may be as happy as they would have been otherwise. Don't care too much about that civilization. They will go on. Had she known all along? He wondered. Had she known that he would fail? Had she sensed how it would be? Perhaps because she was a woman? Perhaps because within her veins ran a different strain of blood? And again, he puzzled over what made greatness, in either man or woman. Josie cared for the house now and for her mother. Josie, herself a mother, straight and full-breasted and walking with easy grace. Of them all, she had grown to be most like M. The others came also to the bedside. The tall sons and the strong daughters and the grandchildren. Already the oldest grandsons were shooting up tall, and on bodies of the granddaughters, the fullness of their womanhood was showing. Looking at them as they passed the bedside, Ish knew that M was right. They will go on, he thought. The simple ones are also the strong ones. They will go on. At last, one day, he sat again holding her hand. She was very weak, and then suddenly he knew that a third and dark presence was there beside them. She spoke no more, and only once he felt a light flutter of her fingers within his hand. Oh, Mother of Nations, he thought, her sons shall praise and her daughters call her blessed. Then, where there had been three, now there was only one, for death had gone and she too. He sat there bowed and dry-eyed. That too was finished. They would bury her, Mother of Nations, and place no marker, for that was their custom. And as it was in the beginning, since love first and sorrow with it came to the world, he sat with his dead, and he knew that greatness had passed from them. Yet still the years flowed, and the sun swung from north of the mountain, south past the Golden Gate, and back again. More years were carved into the rock. One spring, Molly died suddenly of what they took to be heart failure. That same year, a great tumor grew within Jean, swiftly, like a nightmare growth. There was no one who knew how to help her, and when she had died by her own hand, there was no one who blamed her. We are going. We are going, thought Ish. We Americans are old and are dropping like last spring's leaves. So sometimes he was sad. Yet, as he walked along the hillside, he saw many children playing busily, and young men shouting to one another, and mothers nursing their babies, and little sadness and much merriment. One day Ezra came to him, saying,
You should take another wife. Ish looked at him with questioning eyes. No, said Ezra. I am too old. You are younger. There's a young woman of the others and no man to marry her. Except for an old man, it is better not to be alone. And there should be more children. He felt no love, but he took her. She comforted him in the long nights, for he was still a man in his strength. She bore him children, though the children seemed always a little strange to him, scarcely his, because they were not also M's. More years were carved in the rock. Except for Ish and Ezra, all the Americans now were gone. And Ezra was a little dried-up, wrinkled man who coughed and grew thinner and thinner. Ish himself was wholly gray-haired now. Though he was not heavy, his paunch stuck out, and he was thin-legged in the manner of old men. His side hurt him where the mountain lion had clawed him years back, so he walked little. Yet still his young wife bore him a child in the year 42. He was not greatly interested in that child, and also now he had great-grandchildren. On the day when the year 43 had ended, Ish did not feel like walking as far as the flat rock where they carved the numerals, and Ezra was too frail. So they put off carving the date in the rock or giving a name. They said to each other now and then that really they must do it, or else arrange with some of the younger men to carve the numerals, and sometimes also the younger men and even the children talked of it. But in a way that such things go, once it had been put off, still it was put off again. Today is rainy, or it is too cold, or we are going fishing and shall do it later. So the numerals were not carved, and the name was not given, and life went on with no one caring greatly. After that, no one knew how many years passed. Now no more children were born to Ish's young wife. Then one day she came to him with a younger man, and the two asked, respectfully, that Ish should give her to that one. Then at last Ish realized that in this his curious life, he had now come close to the last stage of all. More and more often after that, he and Ezra sat together as two old men. There was nothing strange that two old men should sit together and talk. But what was strange here was that there were no other old people at all. Elsewhere, everything was youth, at least by comparison. There were births and there were deaths, but always there were more births than deaths, and because everyone was youthful, there was much laughter. As the quick years passed and the two old men sat on the hillside in the sun, they began to talk more and more about what had happened long ago. There was little that anyone, they at least, could talk about as far as these years now were concerned. Some years were called good years and some were called bad years, but there was not much difference. So chiefly the two old men talked about things of long ago, and occasionally they speculated about life. Often when they talked, Ish realized that there was still wisdom and help in Ezra. A tribe is like a child, he said once in that thin, piping old man's voice, which every day seemed more like a bird's, and then he coughed. When he recovered, he spoke again. Yes, a tribe is like a child. You can show it the way by which it should grow up, and perhaps you can direct it a little, but in the end, the child will go his own way, and so will the tribe. Yes, he said again on some other day. Time makes all things clear. Everything seems plainer to me now than it once did. And if I should live for 100 years more, perhaps everything that has happened so far would seem very plain and simple. Often they talked of the other Americans, those who now were gone. They laughed, remembering good old George and Maureen with her fine radio that would never play. They smiled when they recalled Jean and her refusal to go to church. Yes, said Ezra,
It is all clearer now with time. Why each of them survived the great disaster, that I still do not know. But I think I can see why each of them survived the shock that came afterward, when so many went under. George and Maureen, and perhaps Molly too, they lived on and did not go crazy because they were stolid and had no imagination. And Jean survived because she had her temper and fought back at life. And I, because I went out from myself and shared the lives of other people. And you and Em. But here Ezra paused, so that Ish himself could speak. Yes, said Ish. You are right, I think. And I could live because I stood at one side and watched what was happening. And as for M, there he too paused, and Ezra spoke again. Well, as we were, so the tribe will be. It will not be brilliant because we were not like that. Perhaps the brilliant ones were not suited to survive. But as for M, there is no need to explain, for we know that she was the strongest of us all. Yes, we needed many things. We needed George and his carpentry, and we needed your foresight, and perhaps we needed my knack of making one person work better with another, even though I did little by myself. But most of all, I think we needed M, for she gave us courage, and without courage there is only a slow dying, not life. Almost while they sat there, it seemed to Ish a fast-growing tree sprang up on the hillside below them and grew until it cut off the view across the bay, where the rust-red towers of the great bridge still stood high. And then after a while, the tree seemed to sicken and die and fall. Again, from where he liked to sit in the sun on the hillside, he could look out and see the bridge. And once, as he looked, there was a great fire raging in the ruinous city beyond the bay. And he remembered that far, far back, even before he had been born, that city had burned before. Now it burned for a week, with the dry north wind driving the flames. There was no one to put it out, and no one even to care whether it burned. When the flames died down, nothing was left to burn. There came a time when even talking seemed a labor. So mostly now Ish merely sat comfortably in the sun, and beside him sat an even older man who coughed and grew thinner. It was hard to tell just how the days passed and how they ran into weeks, and even the years seemed to flow with a man scarcely noticing them. Yet Ezra remained, and sometimes Ish thought to himself, though he coughs and coughs and grows thinner, yet he will outlive me. But now, since even talking was a labor, the mind turned inward on itself, and Ish thought of all this strange life. What was the difference in the end? Even if there had been no great disaster, he would now be a very old man. Now, doubtless, if it had not happened otherwise, he would be Professor Emeritus, puttering around, taking some books out of the library, and intending to do some research. A little of a nuisance to the younger men in their 50s and 60s who now ran the department. Though they might say loyally to the graduate students, that's Professor Williams, a great scholar once. We're very proud of him. Now the old times were deeper buried than Nineveh or Mohenjo-Daro. He himself had seen everything crash and go under. Yet curiously, too, all that crash had not been able to destroy his personality. He was still the same person he would have been as Professor Emeritus, even though now the shadows were closing in on his mind while he sat on a lonely hillside as the dying patriarch of a primitive tribe. At some time in those years, something else strange began to happen. The younger men had always come to Ish for advice, but now, even though the shadows were closing in on his mind, they began to come in a different way. Whether he sat on the hillside in the sun or whether during rain and fog he sat in the house, still they began to come to him bearing little gifts. A handful of ripe berries of which he was fond, or a bright stone or piece of colored glass to flash in the sun. Ish did not care for the glass or stones, even though the stones were sometimes sapphires or emeralds taken from a jewelry store. But he appreciated the gifts because he realized that the young men were giving him things by which they themselves would be pleased. Having given him something, they would formally ask a question while he sat holding his hammer. Sometimes they asked about the weather, and then Ish was glad to answer. He could still look at his father's barometer, and so he could often say, what the young men could not know, whether the low clouds would soon vanish before the sun's heat, or whether they indicated an approaching storm. But sometimes they asked him other questions, as, for instance, in which direction they should go for good hunting. Then Ish did not wish to answer, for he knew nothing of such matters. But when he did not answer, the young men were displeased, and then they would pinch him roughly. Because he was in pain, he answered them, even though he knew nothing. He would cry out, "Go south," or "Go beyond the hills." Then the young men were pleased and went off. Ish sometimes feared that they would come back and pinch him because they had not found good hunting. But they never did. During those years, there were days when he thought clearly, and other days when a fog seemed to hang in all the corners of his brain. But one day, when they came to ask him a question and he was clear-minded, he realized that he must have become a god, or at least an oracle by which a god spoke. Then he remembered that time long ago when the children had been afraid to carry the hammer, and when they had nodded knowingly at his saying he was an American. Yet, he had never wished to be a god. One day, Ish sat on the hillside in the sun, and after a while he looked at his left side and saw that no one sat there. Then he realized that at last Ezra, the good helper, was gone, and that no one would ever sit there beside him on the hillside again. At that thought, he gripped the handle of the hammer, which in these days was very heavy for him to lift, even with both hands. "It is called a single jack," he thought. "But now it is too heavy for my one hand. Yet now it has become the symbol of a tribal god, and it is still with me, though all the others, even Ezra, have gone." Then, because the shock of that sudden knowledge about Ezra had made him think and see more clearly, he looked alertly about him and observed that he was sitting on the slope of the hill where many years before there had been a neat garden and was now only a trampled place of tall grass in the midst of overgrown bushes and high trees, with a half-ruined house standing up from among the tangle. Then he looked at the sun and saw that it was in the east, not in the west, as he had thought it would be. Also, it was far to the north, so that the season must be nearly midsummer, whereas he had thought it should be early spring. Yes, in all those years, as he had sat on the hillside, he had lost hold of time itself, so that the swinging of the sun from east to west with the passing of the day seemed much the same as the swinging of the sun from north to south with the passing of the seasons. And he had lost track of them both. This thought made him feel very old and very sad. Perhaps that sadness brought back to him the thought of other sadness also, and he thought, "Yes, Emma's gone, and Joey, and even Ezra, my helper, is gone now." When he thus recalled all that had happened, and his loneliness, he began to cry gently, for he was an old man, and he could not control what he did. And he thought to himself, "Yes, they are all gone. I am the last American." End of the second interchapter called Quick Years. Part 3. The Last American. "'Tis Mary.
'Tis merry in good greenwood. Old song. Chapter 1. Perhaps it was that same day, or perhaps it was only that same summer, or perhaps even it was another year. When Ish looked up, he saw very clearly a young man standing in front of him. The young man wore a neat enough pair of blue jeans with copper rivets shining brightly, and yet over his shoulders he wore a tawny hide with sharp claws dangling from it. In his hand he held a strong bow, and over his shoulder was a quiver with the feathered ends of arrows sticking from it. Ish blinked, for in his old eyes the sunshine was strong. "Who are you?" said Ish. The young man answered respectfully, "I am Jack Ish, as indeed you yourself well know." The way he said Ish did not indicate that he was trying to be unduly familiar with an old man, thus calling him by a nickname, but rather it carried something of great respect and even of awe, as if Ish stood for much more than merely the name of an old man. But Ish himself was confused, and he squinted, peering more carefully because at short distances he no longer saw clearly. But he was sure that Jack should have dark hair, or perhaps turned somewhat gray by now, and this one who called himself Jack had long, wavy yellow hair. "You should not make jokes with an old man," said Ish. "Jack is my oldest son, and I would recognize him. He has dark hair, and he is older than you." The young man laughed, but politely, and said, "You are talking, Ish, of my grandfather, as indeed you yourself well know." Again, the way in which he said Ish had a certain strange sound to it, and now Ish noticed also the strangeness of his other repeated words, "As indeed you yourself well know." "Are you of the first ones?" Ish asked, "or of the others?" "Of the first ones," he said. Then, as Ish still looked, he was puzzled that the young man, who was certainly not a child, was carrying a bow instead of a rifle. "Why do you not have a rifle?" he asked. "Rifles are good for playthings," the young man said, and he laughed, a little scornfully perhaps. "You cannot be sure of a rifle, as indeed you yourself, Ish, well know. Sometimes the rifle works and it makes the big noise, but other times you pull the trigger and it only goes click." Here he snapped his fingers. "So you cannot use the rifles for real hunting, although the older men say that this was not so in the long past years. But now we use the arrow because it is sure and never refuses to fly. And besides," here the young man held himself proudly, "besides, it is a matter of strength and skill to shoot with the bow. But anyone, they say, could shoot with a rifle, as you yourself, Ish, well know." "Let me see an arrow," said Ish. The young man took an arrow from the quiver and looked at it and then handed it across. "That is a good arrow," he said. "I made it myself." Ish looked at the arrow and felt the weight of it. This was no plaything for a child. The shaft was nearly a yard long, split cleanly from a billet of flawless, straight-grained wood, and then rounded and smoothed. It was well feathered, with pinions of some kind, although Ish could not see well enough to know what bird had yielded the feathers. By feeling, however, he could tell that they were arranged carefully, so that the arrow in flight would spin like a rifle bullet, and thus keep its true course and carry farther. Then he observed the arrow head, again more by feel than by sight. The arrow head was very sharp, both at the point and along the edges. Ish nearly pricked his thumb. It had the bumpy yet slick feel which told him that it was of hammered metal. Though he could not see very clearly, he made the color out as silvery white. "What is that made of?" he asked. "It is from one of the little round things. They have faces on them. The old men have a name for them, but I do not remember exactly. It is something like corns." The young man paused, as if to be told the right word. But when he had no reply, he went on again. being obviously eager to show off his knowledge about arrowheads. We find these little round things in the old buildings. Often there are many, many of them in the boxes and drawers. Sometimes they are rolled up together in bundles like short round sticks, but heavier than sticks. Some are red and some are white, like this one. And there are two kinds of the white. The one kind of white, the one that has the picture of the humpbacked bull, we do not use those because they are harder to pound. Ish considered and thought that he understood. And this white one here, he asked, was there a relief picture on this one? The young man took the arrow from Ish and looked at it, and then handed it back. They all have pictures, he said. But I was looking to see if I could still make out what picture was on this one. It is not quite all gone because of the hammering. This was one of the littlest ones, and it had the picture of the woman with the wings growing out of her head. Some of them have pictures of hawks, but not real hawks. The young man was talking very happily. Others have men, at least they look like men, one with a beard, and one with long hair hanging behind him, and another with a strong-looking face without a beard and with short hair and heavy-jawed. And who do you think were all these men? The young man glanced both ways, as if a little nervous. These? Oh, these. Yes, these we think, as you yourself, Ish, well know, these were the old ones that were before our old ones. When there was no thunder from heaven, and when the young man could see that Ish was not displeased, he went on. Yes, that must be it, as you yourself, Ish, well know. These men, and the hawks and the bull. Perhaps the woman with the wings growing from her head sprang from the marriage of a hawk and a woman, but however it is, they do not seem to mind our taking their pictures and hammering them up for arrowheads. I have wondered about it. Perhaps they are too great to care about little things. Or perhaps they did their work a long time ago and have now grown old and weak. He stopped talking, but Ish could see that he was pleased with himself and liked to talk, and was thinking quickly of something more to say. He at least had imagination. Yes, the young man continued. I have an idea. Our old ones, they were the Americans, made the houses and bridges and the little round things that we hammer out for arrowheads. But those others, the old ones of the old ones, perhaps they made the hills and the sun and the Americans themselves. Then, though it was a cheap trick to play on the young man, Ish could not resist talking in double meaning. Yes, he said. I have heard it said that those older old ones produced the Americans. But I rather doubt that they made the hills and the sun. Though he could not have understood, perhaps the young man caught the irony in the tone and so said nothing. But go on, Ish continued then. Tell me more about the arrowheads themselves. I'm not interested in your cosmogony. He used the last word in good-humored malice, knowing that the other would not understand it, but would be impressed by its length and strange sound. Yes, about the arrowheads, the young man said, hesitating a moment, and then regaining confidence. We use both the red and the white. The red are good for shooting cattle and lions. The white are for deer and other game. Why is that? Ish asked sharply, for he felt his old-time rationalism stirring at the thought of all such magic and hocus-pocus. The question, however, seemed only to surprise and confuse the young man. Why? He asked. Why? How could anyone know why? Except you yourself, Ish. This matter of the red and white arrowheads is merely something that is. It is like... He hesitated, and then the sunlight seemed to catch his attention.